Greetings from Sri Bhakti Sandarbha, Anuche 84. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Someone just came on. Okay. Hi, Bo. Mooney, you can still hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know what that was.
Okay. Namah Mantra. The question may be raised that since the name of the Lord is independent, how can mantras, also composed of the names of the Lord, be dependent on diksha? Difference between the names and other mantras is that mantras contain certain specific words such as namaha, obeisances to you. Furthermore, they are infused with special power, either by the Lord or the sage, great sages, and establish a unique relationship with the Lord. So when even the name alone is independent of any process and could bestow all results up to the supreme goal in life, how can a mantra whose power is greater even than the name be dependent upon diksha? Omigana Timarandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Raksuramutamyena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vijaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Yambhu Pukadhamayam Kadati Svapadam Dukam Adadana Sinandante Idam Yache Puna Puna Srimadu Papadam Bhoja Visham Janma Janmani Vairagya Bhakti Visham Payatnai Apayam Amanabhit Sandham Sukham Buddhiya Paradhuka Dhuki Satanastam Prabhumasriyami Mancha Kaupa Tarugyasya Vaksindhu Bhai Bhaja Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Advaita Gadadha Srivasadi Horabhakta Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Namo Hare Namo Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from Overdon, in the place that I stayed last year. Really ideal place. My room, you know, faces a beautiful garden. There's a malati kunj of flowers. And even since last year, the garden has been developed. And I'm facing Govardhan Hill. Something invoked auspiciousness for my travels because I never had an easier travel to Vrindavan. He took lunch at Govardhan Lal's in Jai Subhadra's and then some rest. Govardhan Lal drove me to the airport. It only took about 5 minutes to check in. Got on the plane. No one was sitting next to me. And in the window seat was a nice gentleman, doctor in chemistry, really respectful person. Had a nice godbrother on the plane, Charu, who does Gilchrist Indian Temple in Spanish Forks, Utah, real nice. One lady approached me and asked me if I was a Hare Krishna, and she's a med student coming to India for the first time to go to some medical camp in Sikkim. Come back to Vrindavan to learn more about Krishna. stopped there, went to, some of you know, Ramadar and Ghanisham's house. Very gracious mother was waiting up. You know, the flight is only 13 hours, so that means by the time you get in the plane, sit down, take rest, get up, there's only about 4 or 5 hours left on the trip. Really nice. Went to Ghanisham's house. Looked wonderful. Sodom. Got a room for me, rested. Got up in the morning. My sadhana and Gopal, the taxi driver, drove me directly. Radhakund. I never entered the Dham unless first bathing. And when I bathed in Radhakund, drove me back to the place, unpacked, and then lunch with Arati. Quite a very auspicious and wonderful year in Dham. It's a very nice time of the year also. I was planning on doing Govardhan Prakram when I came. Just try to enter with a little bit of austerities, but morning is the class. So give a little review first, but somehow the electricity went out. So I mentioned before that for me to speak, I need my hands. So now I just got my phone back, but the earplugs, I have to hold my phone. I have to hold a flashlight. I'm quite restricted in that way. But we're on the section of Archana. I did a little study more, and it's a very interesting section. And it begins by explaining that details of the worship, the details meaning on Patishta, the establishment of deities, those details of worship are not given actually in the Vedas, they're given in the Agamas. That means which comes after the Vedas, which you also can call the Tantras, where you learn the different rituals of working matter to purify yourself. Deity worship is described in there. And made a very interesting point that, of course, any of the particular items of devotional service are sufficient in themselves, bring one to perfection, but if one desires a specific relationship with the Lord, then one cultivates that through the worship of the deity. That's recommended by Narada Muni. And one should take, therefore, diksha, the mantra for worshiping a specific deity. And basically, one of the important aspects of diksha is formally connecting one a particular line which worships Krishna in a specific way. Of course, in our line, it's Radha Krishna and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That person should certainly perform archana after accepting initiation. And there was a nice definition of diksha. Sha means to destroy, it eradicates all sins. D, it imparts divine wisdom. So that type of firm commitment some type of internal transformation. Just like in a traditional marriage, boy and girl goes together, and there's marriage. So what is different? They were associating before. There's some extra form. In that formality and that commitment, there's some greater depth of commitment. And in spiritual life, that greater depth of commitment invokes a reciprocation from the Supreme Lord. that purifies one and brings one closer to him. And also, because one is being initiated into a particular sampradaya, a particular line of teachers, that initiation is Bhagavat Swarup Gyan, the form of a particular Lord that you worship, and some under the Shesh Gyan, specific relationship with Krishna, just a relationship with the deity that you worship. I also discussed in the previous class that to understand what's being talked here about initiation, to understand that traditionally the commitment would come when you would get the Diksha mantras. And right, Srila Prabhupada, I explained the reasons why. I'm not going to go into that again today, but Srila Prabhupada gave that type of commitment when one got Nam. Or even in the Gaudiya Math, traditionally, if you go to a village of thousands and thousands of people, they wanted to link people with spiritual life who became inspired, but they didn't have so much knowledge yet. You know, in India, they had so many different conceptions of spiritual life. They would give them Nam, just to purify them. And then of those people, those who would really become serious and commit themselves, later they would get Diksha, or the formally connected with the line, and get which would be significant to them. When we come to spiritual life, we don't know anything. As soon as we have a little faith, we're already connected with that particular line in some way, or the conceptions of that particular line. You know, people come to the temple for many, many years. They accept Brahma and Krishna. They accept Gaudiya Thai. They just haven't become qualified yet for get initiated or become, so to speak, a second initiate. But in a vision, when these books were written, you know, people had all kinds of conceptions of spiritual life. But when there was a real commitment to a specific conception and a specific line, then one would be qualified for initiation into that line, and he would get the mantras which embody the devata or the deity of that particular line. And we discussed that before. And then there was a section on an archana that it's specifically recommended for householders. Described that if one lacks that worship, if one neglects that worship and tries to focus exclusively on practices like remembrance, although one has sufficient means, and that money is not purified and not used by worshiping the deity, miserly may come in, which happens if you accrue money without connecting that money in some way, especially the excess money in some way, Krishna. Perhaps this would be a worship of the deity. And or if you know you would worship through others, then you can become lazy in your worship. But interesting point. But because householders require strict regulations to set priorities, because there's so many pressing needs in their life, especially they should take deity worship, which requires diksha, which requires some firm commitment, some particular spiritual practices. Otherwise, they could use their wealth in charity in so many ways, but that won't have the same purificatory benefit as one does archana, which requires diksha, which gives certain firm commitments. And then he also discussed um,
that Archana also, in invite Diksha Archana into a Vaishnav line, connects you with the root of all worship, which is Vishnu. Otherwise, you'll just sacrifice the various gods and you won't really have the conception of Krishna as the Supreme Lord. It's like watering the branches and the leaves and not watering the root. And various considerations for worship were also discussed, even if you're unable or unqualified, can witness or approve. Unqualified means that you're disabled or for some reason unqualified, or my note here said here, pleased or whatever the case, you can still approve the worship. And therefore, in every village in India, there was a deity. Before eating, before performing an activity, one would see the Lord. Again, it was a way to prioritize God in materialistic life. People with so many family responsibilities, business responsibilities, social responsibilities, but one would first worship the deity. So it would set some type of priority in their life. That's a very wonderful thing about deity worship. And Diksha, it sets some commitments or priorities, some obligations or duty. Otherwise, one could get carried away with all the things one has to do. And one could also worship mentally. There's verses there that so discuss that. I have here. Okay. I think that kind of more or less. Okay. I just want to read. I got a little lost here. I'll be right back with you. Stay with me. Yeah, okay. So there's other considerations during worship. Let me just read something, because somehow I can't put it in context. It'll come to me. Rather, on the path of Archana, following scriptural injunctions is compulsory, and hence Diksha is a prerequisite to worship. Thereafter, one should learn the scriptural procedure of worship from one's teacher. It also brings one into some kind of educational process of the scriptures. The importance of Diksha is stated in the Agama. The Brahmins who have not yet undergone sacred thread ceremony do not have the right to assume their prescribed duties, such as studying the Vedas. They acquire this authority only after being invested with the power of the ceremony. Therefore, those who are not initiated do not have the right to chant mantras and worship the deity. Therefore, one should make oneself fortunate by accepting initiation. As standard, the Alaba line, because there's different lines that stress different things, which stresses deity worship. When one gets initiated, he gets the deity. He gets a particular deity, that's his relationship with Krishna. And their whole process of sadhana is worshiping the deity at different standards. So, importance of following the scriptural procedures of worship is prescribed in the Vishnu Raja. One who worships the deity of Lord Hari with reverence, yet without knowing the prescribed procedure of worship, obtains only 1% of the benefit doing it properly. If one worships the deity with great reverence, as indicated by the adverb bhaktiya, yet without acquaintance with prescribed procedures, one obtains only 1% of benefit, if even that, Jiva Goswami that the guiding authority in the matter of the procedures of worship is the Vaishnava Sampradaya, or knowledge received in the Sikh procession. They're very interesting. There are so many different worships, so many different paddhatis to follow. Which one should one follow? Well, you follow according to your own Vaishnava Sampradaya. There's different archana paddhatis, step-by-step procedures of worship. There's so many different ways in which to do it. Which one you should follow? That one, and when you follow your particular who in that specific succession should you follow? And it mentions the qualification. One should embrace the words only of those always worship Vishnu, body, mind, and speech, for they are as honorable as Vishnu. Have doubt? You should ask people you accept as authority, how we should do this. And in the Karma Purana, one should inquire about Lord Vishnu from Vaishnavas who are Brahmins, adept in the conclusion of scriptures, engaged in vows, and whose conduct is rooted in truth. One should follow their instructions with great care. Vaishnav Tantra, one should completely avoid the instructions of those who are not devoted to their guru, their mantras, and the Supreme Lord Vishnu. And then it gives an example from the Srimad Bhagavatam. In other words, point here, one of the considerations of worship is how do you know how to worship? Well, you approach a proper, you first of all, worship within your line, your particular Vaishnava line, and within that line, you consult an authority in the matter. And the example is given here of King Ambarish. And we know the story with Durvasa Muni. He was following a particular strict vow, and he had to break his fast, and he couldn't eat before he broke his fast. And then that Durvasa Muni came, and I forgot what the exact dilemma was. But the point is, whatever dilemma he had, verses here from the Bhagavatam, it says, being thus fully devoted and always offering his action, Lord Krishna is the absolute and the enjoyer of sacrifice. He ruled the earth following the instructions received from the Brahmins who were devoted. So there's the reference from Jiva Goswami. He followed according to the practice, according to the Brahmins, the particular authorities. Now, a very interesting question comes up about Nam and do you actually have to take initiation? Do you have to actually take diksha? In other words, and the question that's going to come up is, aren't the names of God and the mantras which use those names of God independent of any other purificatory process? Is the holy name of Krishna, are the sampradayic mantras, do they require some type of purificatory process to make them proper? For example, we know in the story of Vritrasura, you know, there's certain mantras that one chants, and within those mantras that one chants, you know, there's particular prerequisites of how they're chanted. You have to learn, you know, before the mantra takes effect, there's particular prerequisites in chanting the Sanskrit. And we know with the story of Vritrasura, when the mantra was chanted, it was supposed to be the demon that was created was supposed to, what was it? It was an enemy of Indra, but by not chanting it properly, it changed the meaning to one who Indra, who rather than create the demon who was the enemy of Indra, which was the purpose of the mantra, it just changed slightly, and it created a demon whom Indra was the enemy. or it reversed the effect. Rather than this demon be able to kill Indra, Indra would be able to kill the demon. So they know that in mantras there's usually some prerequisite of pronunciation, purificatory rite. But the point here is that the holy names of God are independent. Nam nam akaru bahuda nijasarva saktis tarpita nimata paranena kala. There's a tajrasi Nam akari bahudan nijasarva shaktis tarpita nimata. There's no rules or regulations. You said they have all shakti or potency. They're not dependent on any rules to activate them. But here's the question. Then why do you have to take diksha to get mantra or to worship or to chant the holy name? The question may be raised that since the name of the Lord is independent, how can mantras, which are also composed of names, be dependent on diksha? So the point here is the name and of course the mantra are independent. So the answer is going to be given here, why you have to take diksha when the mantra is independent. It can be, it has independent power. It's not dependent on anything. It has its own sarup, shakti. The shakti is within it. Doesn't have to be activated in any other way. Because I'm just doing this in India for the first time, I want to make sure I'm still connected to people. Are you still there? Can someone say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Hare Bol Maharaj. Hare Bol. Okay. Great, I'm still connected. So here it says, this may be answered as follows. By constitution, mantras are not dependent on diksha. Nevertheless, because human beings are by nature prone to unvirtuous conduct and mental disturbance due to bodily identification. In other words, from a philosophical standpoint, there's no need. From a practical view, there's need. From the practical view, there is a vow or a commitment which regulates one. In other words, because of attachment to the body, we don't behave and we're agitated. So to curb that tendency, and therefore we commit offenses, and that affects chanting the holy name, and that affects chanting mantras. So to curb that tendency and control the mind, we need some regulation. So this is the purpose for, and thus take diksha and have proper authority. It gives us some type of regulation to help us purify the mind. So in order to curb these tendencies, the rishis have established certain regulations and parts of the scriptures to be followed in the path of archana. So if those regulations are not followed, scriptures describe various atonement. There is no incongruity between the name and the mantras, and that neither one by nature is dependent on diksha. So the reconciliation is yes, it's independent, but because we're attached to the body, then we're generally disturbed by the mind, and therefore to get the full effect of our meditation on mantra, we have to be regulated under the proper authority. And that's really the commitment of diksha, to regulate my life
under the proper authority, whom I have faith and affection in. That enables one to the extent that one could make that commitment, and enables one to transcend and therefore make a veil of the name and the mantra in one's meditation. So from a practical standpoint, it's recommended. Now what he's going to do here is he's going to give so many statements of the independence of the mantra, and then he's going to give statements where there are verses that strongly recommend the mantra. So the first one is the ultimate philosophical basis of the mantra being independent. There'll be verses, and then there'll be verses that appear to contradict it, which prescribe the absolute necessity of that type of adherence to creation and the rules and the proper authorities, etc. And basically, the need is a practical need. So here are these verses statements. Even amongst Vaishnav mantras, the mantra of Lord Ram bestows greater benefit, millions of times more powerful than mantras such as that of Ganesh. O best of the Brahmins, this mantra awards perfection simply by chanting it, even without diksha, without preparatory rites, purusharya, or mental assignment of deities to different parts of the body, nyas, without the prerequisite purificatory processes, it still can give perfection. And then there's no reference that there's reference here that there's no need of testing the mantra for efficacy, as in the mantra Deva Kartika. It says the mantras of the sun god, Vaishnav mantras, and the mantras relating to Srinivasa are independent of any consideration of the relative stages of efficacy of mantras, technically known as sadha, sadhya siddha, susiddha, and ari. Ari means inimical, sadhya means test whether it's suitable or it's inimical. You know, there's certain mantras that you test because they're to destroy people, so you test the enmity of the mantra before it works. There's certain, and that's the story of the Dhritarashtra when the mantra, when they wanted to created the mantra to create a demon. They wanted a demon to kill Indra. So because the mantra was chanted improperly, it wasn't tested for its ari or enmity, it had the opposite result. So there's a test that's done properly in the proper order, in the proper procedure, in the proper pronunciation. Otherwise, it doesn't have the effect. What it's saying is that's not the case of the Vaishnav mantras here. It's mentioned the Sringa mantras, even mantras to the sun god. They're independent. In another tantra, purification of mantras is forbidden in the case of the mantras in the Sringa, sun god, and Varaha, the self-manifest syllable Om, and the mantras in the Vedas. And the Sanat Kumar Samhita, it said, O Narada, because the Gopal mantra is self-manifest, it is independent of any consideration of Sadhya, Siddha, Susiddhi, and Ari. So Gopal mantra, that's the mantra that's given in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. That's the mantra that we chant. And that mantra will reveal Gopal. So again, it says it's independent of any prerequisite. And elsewhere, the Gopal mantra swiftly delivers the results coveted by people of all castes, stages of life, by all women, and by those born under any circumstances. So that's the one side. It's independent. Now he gives the other side, Jiva Goswami. The other side is
the need for following regulations in regards to mantras. And so he quotes it up from the Brahma Yamala. Even one point of devotion to Lord Hari executed without following the ordinances of the Vedas, the Smriti, the Puranas, and the Pancharatna simply caused disturbance. That's a very, very famous verse. Shruti, Smriti, Puranadi. Shruti, Smriti. Shruti, the Vedas, Smriti, those that are things are written in pursuance of the Vedas by the great sages, Puranadi, the Puranas and other scriptures. Shruti, Smriti, Puranadi, Pancharatna, Jitinbada. Point the key here about the Agrakulpa, that it'll cause disturbance, even if it's bhakti. So it's mentioned that. Then it discusses the Mother Earth in speaks in the fourth canto. Something that's relevant here. He said, sages who have realized the absolute have devised and implemented many means to bring about the welfare of human beings, both in this life and the next. Anyone who faithfully and wholeheartedly follows the path revealed by the sages of yore easily achieves his or desired goal. But the unwise who disregard these methods and take to their own concocted processes find that their efforts and the means they apply meet with failure again and again. And there's a dialogue in the Padma Purana between Lord Narayan and Narada. Where not, Lord Narayan says, "O sage, a devotee of mine who duly worships my deity, form according to scriptural injunctions, faces no obstacles, even in dreams. He or she is fearless." So, let's check other watch here. Okay, so just discuss the necessity, the practical necessity for a type of commitment under a spiritual authority to regulate one's life and purify one's mind. And from a practical necessity, recommended, although philosophically still the mantra is independent. Mantra is independent. It's still powerful and very pure, and there are no hard and fast rules for chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. And also the Diksha mantras, they have their potency within them. So they don't need to be activated externally. But from a particular standpoint, our receptivity to their potency, our receptivity for the potency will make them more effective. The mantra, it's like the sun. The sun doesn't need to be activated. But if you're in the shade, you won't get the benefit of it. But there's other types of mantras, etc., that are not activated unless there's particular prerequisite for them. But it's not true if you put the holy name. But here, I guess the mantra, the Diksha mantras that have the holy name in them and embody a particular deity, and the holy name itself, They are pure within itself. Potency is still there independently. But to take a veil of it and feel the full benefit of it, one has to regulate his life. And you can imagine also these books are written when people made vows, they followed those vows. They had that power to follow those vows. And therefore, when they made a commitment, it was such a serious thing that it would be extremely purificatory for them. And it's the same thing. We see Prabhupada and his followers, is there's potency. And that type of commitment is there. Without that commitment, there's Bhagavad Vidhi and Antaratra Vidhi, like two lines of a track. And yes, there's chanting and hearing, and it's very powerful to chant and hear. But the deity and the worship of the deity, which means that the morning program, there's greeting the deities, there's Mangal Arati, so many things are there, that type of regulation, etc., is also necessary. And that's facilitated by that type of commitment that is made. Okay, I'm sure this leaves plenty of room for discussion. The next section here is any questions?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna.
Can you give more graphic or something more detailed illustration of how Aparad can reduce our receptivity to the potency of the holy names?
Yeah. Aparad. Rad means worship. Upa means to distance from Radha, to distance from worship. Well, it has two effects. One, I'm reading something very important. I was reading that.
I mean, using some examples.
Let me please. I'm doing it. I have to think very deeply. So once you ask a question, I have to be able to respond. And this medium is very difficult to do, so I can't be interrupted like that. I'm just thinking of this thing, and it's I want to find it. Okay. Really thinking. It's location of. In the Yoga Sutras, right? It recommends, right? In the Yoga Sutras, it recommends. I'm studying this on the plane here. Patanjali recommends that. The whole purpose of yoga, it's very, very clear. Yoga means to control the mind. And when we control the mind, then the self realizes. One doesn't control the mind, then and one becomes absorbed in the turnings of the mind, then one remains absorbed in the false conception of life. But he recommends different ways to do this, but it becomes very, very clear in the Yoga Sutras that the ultimate recommendation is Ishvara Prani, that one should worship God. And the reason that's given in the commentaries is that there's a grace from God. There's a grace from God. There's a reciprocation from God for that worship. So aparad means against worship. It's a personal relationship with God. So when you offend, then you cut off the flow of mercy. Now, you cut it off in one sense, just in terms of that when you worship God, and Trindata Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hyantasolya Bhajani, vidinoti siddhita. Shrindata swakata punya. It's very, very purifying when you chant and hear about Krishna. When you shravana kirtana. It's very, very purifying. And shrindata swakata krishna punya shravana adhyantisto yubhajani vidinoti siddhita. And it cleanses the heart. Why sirit sitam? Surit sitam. He is close to the devotee. Surit. He's close in heart to the devotee. There is a reciprocation from Krishna for our worship. And aparad means what? It's a mentality. It's a mentality of disrespect. That's why the tenth offense, which is inattention. Aparad means inattention. It means neglect. So it's an expression of disregard, and therefore the reciprocation isn't there, and it affects our consciousness. In other words, spiritual life is consciousness. It's a relationship with God. And ultimately, the revelation of God is due to our desire to have it. We're here by desire. So aparad, it's so heavy. So when you offend someone, it's not only an external thing, but internally, it's so heavy. It does something to your consciousness. It also mentions previous that every person can take a veil of the mercy of God without knowing it, except those who become proud. So it affects our consciousness. It covers also our consciousness and our ability to. It cuts off the flow of mercy, and whatever mercy is there, it creates a consciousness where we're unable to appreciate it. So you want a specific now example? Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you mean by a specific example? Like someone doing something?
Yeah.
Great book written, The Heart of Krishna. I mean, examples from the Bhagavatam about people who've offended devotees and there's no response. Well, what kind of example do you want? From the Shastra, a personal example?
I didn't have a particular type of example in mind. I just wanted to get a better.
Here's an example. Lord Chaitanya. Ramachandra Puri, he was criticizing Lord Chaitanya all the time. And because he was criticizing Lord Chaitanya, when his own guru left the world, his guru condemned him. It creates, the story of Ramachandra Puri, he was criticizing Lord. He saw some ants in his room and he was saying, oh, just see, there must be sweets here. What kind of sannyasi are you? You know, he was criticizing him like that. And because he criticized him in that way, completely lost his ability to understand his guru. When his guru was leaving, his guru was in ecstasy. His guru in ecstasy was saying, oh, you know, he was crying in separation. And Ramachandra Puri, instructed his own guru. What? Did that?
I don't know who that was.
He instructed his own guru. Said, why don't you just, meditate on Brahman? So if you want to read a great book, there's a book called The Heart of Krishna by Bhakti Pramod Puri. Gives every example from the Bhagavatam of the different offenses. Or another one is Gopala and Chakravarti. When Haridas Thakur was in the assembly of Govardhan and Hiranyaman Sundara, he was in that assembly and he was they were glorifying the holy name, and all the Brahmins were saying that by the holy name, you can get liberation. And Haridas Thakur said, liberation, that's just a faint glimpse of the holy name. That's only Nam-Bas. By Nam-Bas, a faint glimpse of the holy name, you get liberation. The real glory of the holy name is that it gives pure love of Godhead. And then Gokula Chakravarti, because liberation is such a difficult goal, and he heard that just by a bas, a faint glimpse of the holy name, one could get purified. He criticized and he cursed Haridas Thakur. He got leprosy afterwards. So I don't know what kind of examples you want, but it's filled with examples in the Shastra. And I can tell you very frankly also that I'm just seeing that you look at the initial people who took the position of, they say, the zonal acharyas. Except for a few, most of them had horrible fall downs, horrible things. And it's just a scientific fact. Just a scientific fact that the nature, especially of an offense to a devotee, it just has an effect in one's consciousness that covers the soul. Enmity against Krishna's representatives, neglect. When you mistreat the devotees, it covers the soul. I've just seen it scientifically. It's just a science. One reason why we serve the devotees of Krishna is because Krishna always wants to serve his devotees. Krishna is bound by the love of his devotees. And it's hard for Krishna to serve his devotees because they're his subordinates. By serving the devotees, can actually do something that's even difficult for Krishna to do. Not to speak of offending those people. And here's the point, the real practicality is Krishna is a person. He loves his devotees. So if you offend those whom Krishna loves, then you're affecting your relationship with Krishna. Any other questions?
Yeah, I guess the basic way I would put it then is that, you know, when you commit an apava, you're basically telling Krishna that, you know, I'm not really so interested in, you know, having the association of you and the devotee.
Yeah. Basically, it is. It's not only that, but it creates that consciousness in the heart. Any other questions?
Maharaj?
Yes.
Maharaj?
Yeah, Hare Krishna, who is this?
Hare Krishna, this is Madan.
Madan, Hare Krishna, by the way, that was a very nice meaning of the Vyasa Puja.
Oh, thank you.
Really nice.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah.
I have something just came to mind. I can't remember. Is this loud enough? Am I speaking loud enough?
You're very clear. It's great.
Oh, okay. Something just in the past couple of minutes that in your exchange with Gail brought this to mind. So I haven't really thought it through, but. Regarding offenses, I guess I tend to think of the whole concept of offending devotees in terms of when I first contacted that idea, that concept, it was as a new, a new devotee, when I was a new devotee. So I tended to, I internalized the concept of offending as, being where someone less experienced and younger and newer like myself would do something improper towards someone who was further along than myself. So that's my sort of own experience of it, and that's how I still sort of tend to think about it primarily. But how can I assume that the you know, it's, I guess it can work. I mean, certainly it can work the other direction also, but that's a little less clear to me, I guess, what might characterize or any, I guess, you know, I'd be interested to hear any thoughts about how, let's say, a, you know, more experienced person, a more senior or advanced person might run the risk of offending someone who's less experienced. I mean, I can, you know, it would seem like it would be easy to, in the course of, let's say, trying to even help someone who is younger than us or junior to us, because of that relationship where, you know, if I was in the position of being, you know, in some way, I was in a position where it was sort of like I was in the superior position, it would seem very conducive to committing another type of, I don't know, offense or something. So something about that came to mind, and I haven't really formulated it into a really good question.
I can understand. It's an interesting point, but it's interesting, too, that it somehow come to this, but you see, in a relationship, respect goes upward and affection goes downward.
Yeah.
So, you know, so obviously, be superior in one sense, got this whole thing of respect that you can't violate. You know,
yeah.
In terms of, you know, the carefulness of the approach and I don't want this to be misunderstood. So I also have to, I don't know if, let me see if I could, you know, there's certain etiquette, et cetera. For example, you can't criticize or chastise your superior, but, you know, you can do that. You know?
Right,
but
right.
There's some kind of leeway, but I guess there's you know, offense is offense. You know, it just may be a different realm. You know, it may be a little bit more parameters to superior. You know, in terms of the offenses one can make, maybe a little bit more narrow. You know, and taking a position of authority, and maybe a little bit more broad. You know, in terms of you may chastise someone or neglect someone or. Unless it's still, once you go beyond those parameters, it's still a sense. You know, so it may just be different parameters. You know, it's a Vaishnava Purana. I mean, they list the six ways not to be happy to see a Vaishnava, you know, not to see him through the door, not to, you know, you know, those types of offenses are still applicable in any relationship. But I guess there's something when you're taking a position of a teacher, you know, or a parent, et cetera, that gives you a little bit more parameters, you know, in terms of discipline and instruction. But still, you can't stick to outside of those parameters, otherwise you also enjoy the community. But obviously the parameters are a little bit different. But mostly, you know, we're basically mostly dealing, I think, with people who are basically it's not defined, they're just sort of equals or Vaishnavas. I mean, they are superiors. You know, especially if they're Vaishnav looks. But there may be some special relationships where you are the
guru or the teacher or the father, and the parameters of son, wife, daughter. But most relationships are not like that. Most are equal or superior. Well, and therefore there are quite careful parameters which we have to deal with, even with an equal. Well, we have to be happy to see a Vaishnav, or we discussed that before, or even see him through the door. It's very narrow parameters, in a good way, that where you have to use your can up over those parameters of respect and regard. You know, so I think something like that. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, that makes plenty of sense. And just one thing that, if I may say just one thought. When you first mentioned, you were saying how the characteristic of, from a junior to a senior, the disposition is, the relationship is, you know, that of respect, and from a senior to a junior person, so to speak, it's effect. Well, you were saying, I guess, respect goes up and affection comes down. So I guess that
respect and reverence, and then from the top, it's affection or compassion.
So in one sense, it would seem that for a junior person to fail to give respect in some way, depending on what the degree is, that would constitute an offense, and vice versa, that if a senior person neglects to give affection, is that the sort of character, would that be the sort of basis for something being...
Well, if you said if the neglect of affection manifests in not just the neglect of affection, I guess so.
It sounds kind of strange to me.
If it manifests in something that, if it's like a neglect of affection and some cruelty, or neglect of one's duty or something, I'm sure that's some form of offense.
Would it be in your mind, is it for a person who is in a superior position, it would seem that those who are in a superior position, the need for affection from people who are spiritually advanced, there's such a great need for that in the world, and certainly among devotees, for a person in that position to not be, very affectionate, in one sense it seems like more harm, that there's more of a need, that's almost like, seems to be like a greater loss for those who are capable of giving affection to not do so than it is for some individual who sort of isn't very experienced and doesn't know any better to, by virtue of not knowing any better, fail to give respect. It seems like there's more...
Seriously.
Yeah, in one sense, it seems more serious when somebody who's in a position to help.
This conversation, I mean, it's interesting.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
No. What I'm saying is, I don't really have grasp on it completely. I'm not sure exactly what the point is. I'll give you an example, right?
Yeah.
you know, but how things, we, you know, I think we have to really think about this, and I'm really going to think about this, because I'm thinking something like, for example, yeah, it's, let's say if someone is the father, for example, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the father, you know, generally, let's say, not exactly, but there's a protective figure and there's a nurturing figure, right? So the father sets boundaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is necessary for the child. And the mother is more, you know, unconditional love, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure where we're going. We don't want it to be like an offense, right? where the father withdraws his affection, you know, because the child is not behaving. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, he kind of, or the father is, you know, like a little bit grave and distant because that's his role in the relationship, you know. So I look at the offense more when you know, it's not the affection, it's just the sentiment that's coming there, but it's the welfare. And if there's any offense, it's when one doesn't act for the welfare.
Uh-huh.
And not acting for the welfare, you know, there could be like sentimental affection too, you know.
Sure, of course.
Where the father becomes the friend, right?
Yeah.
You know, so we're looking for something else, and it's somehow or other, I know it could be the jet lag. I don't want to give any excuses, but I'm not kind of connecting to the depth I want today, but I'm really, really want to get to like the core. I really have to think of it. My brain doesn't seem to want to go that far.
Yeah.
You know, I even like to start the next class. I really like, you know, I mean, I think Gail brought up some legitimate questions. Really, what is the essence of offense? And the essence of offense generally is to neglect God, right? And that neglect, you know, that neglect, like for example, you know, you're chanting the holy name, you're inattentive. It's like Krishna's come and you ignore Krishna, you know? Okay, if you ignore Krishna, then one thing, you're not going to get Krishna's mercy. That's one effect of ignoring Krishna. It's the same thing. Krishna may respond, just as a person. Even out of affection, they respond. Okay, this is your consciousness, well, now I'm going to disappear from you. And you're going to have to change your consciousness to actually get to me. So I think I'm going to try to define and see if this sits well. But the core of offense is neglect. And due to that neglect of Krishna, in turn, you know, due to that neglect of Krishna, two things happen. You shut your consciousness from Krishna. And Krishna, to bring you to the proper consciousness, actually neglects you. Right? So I would say, now let's take that in different relationships. So in terms of the superior, the neglect would not be offering sufficient respect. That's neglect. You know, the guru comes in the room, you know, one just keeps on, you know, munching on his sandwich and sitting down, you know? you know, excuse me, and then, you know, quickly tries to chew his food and, like, you know, stands up, and, you know, some type of And I guess if we look at it neglect, then what would be the neglect of, the neglect of the superior would not to be do his duties, but his duties doesn't necessarily mean to become the friend of the disciple, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The affection could mean, you know, that affection could mean, again, the neglect of the subordinate may be maintaining the relationship when the subordinate doesn't offer the proper respect rather than turn away from it to teach them a lesson, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to let this sit with you and sit with others, and that the core essence of offense is neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And that neglect... It shuts your consciousness off from worship, from being close to Krishna, and that neglect, also Krishna responds by distancing himself also to help your consciousness. Also, if we think that Krishna is merciful and he wants good,
how that applies in different circumstances, that can play out in different ways. But certainly, if you say of a superior, that the lack of affection comes in neglecting someone's needs, neglecting someone's, you know, emotional needs, his physical needs, yes, one is committing an offense. But I don't think that neglect of the emotional or physical needs necessarily in terms of a superior has to be kind of an adult indulgence in the relationship. It could be a withdrawal of the relationship, won't be neglect. It's actually the person's concern. You know?
Sure, sure.
Okay, you want to sit on that one?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, let's, Gail, are you still there?
Hi, Krishnamurti.
Does that make sense now, the core being neglect?
Yeah, well, I was feeling so very grateful to Madan Mohan for having, you know, brought these, you know, instructions out of you, you know, because that's, you know, that was nice hearing that definition of the core essence of what it means, you know, apparat. And also, I also really, really appreciated, you know, hearing the fact that, you know, the neglect of the superior, whether it's, you know, Krishna himself or his representative, is also another form of love, you know, because of its intention.
Yeah, that's
you know. So thank
one
you.
One thing
so
I'm going
to...
Thank you.
One thing I'm going to do today is for everyone attended the class. Somehow or other, I don't know, I didn't feel my grasp of the subject somehow. I don't know why it was not, or how my mind works better. But I will offer my obeisances to Govardhan on behalf of everyone in the class. Back right now, because I have this stuff on, I'm castrated obeisances to Govardhan. Offering obeisances on behalf of everyone, praying that you will get benefit from his mercy. Would anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Okay, that's, I think, Nanda Dula. Is that Stella?
Yes, Haribo, and Carl, too. Thank you, Maharaj. it's so wonderful to think of you in India. It really makes us very happy.
I'm feeling really good here. I mean, I was just with Keshav Bharti yesterday, Maharaj, afternoon, and he's doing really well. I'm going to send him both of your regards because I know how much you both love him.
All our love. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm going to really be able to hopefully get deep into studies here because it's a whole different phenomenon. I don't have to move for 2 months. I got all my books out and my studying and writing. I hope to increase the depth of the Gandhis while I'm here. Thank you.
Right.
Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Is that you, Govardhan?
Govardhan, thank you for always listening. Thank you so much. That was great. And by the way, the preparations that came from your house for the Aspuja were very excellent. That's Burfi. My mother especially liked Burfi, I should tell you that. She told me. So that was great. Thank you.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Anastasia.
Anastasia, would you like to speak to your brother?
Oh, he is there.
Just hold on the line for a second. Just
walk. Oh, okay.
If you want. Okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj.
Who's that?
Kishori Radha.
Kishori Radha, Haribo. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. It's Paramananda.
Hey, Paramananda, you know you're Govardhan Srila?
Yeah.
Yeah, I kept it in this ashram on the sutra with these refuelers.
Really? That's fantastic.
Is he still here? I was looking for him this morning, actually.
And he's still there?
He's still there, but because he's been out in the sun and the rain.
Uh-huh.
His eyes washed off.
Oh, really?
But he's still there. I was looking for him this morning. There's a stumba out in the garden. That's where I put the Shila. But he's
mm-hmm.
still there.
That's amazing, though.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, thank you. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Okay, we'll all say Vanshakulpa Turbhya Shabha Anastasia. I can never pronounce the name. Nityananda is laughing now. Everyone else can go off, and then Nityananda could speak to his sister for a few. Okay? Hey, we'll go Vanshakulpa Turbhya Shabha Kripasin Nibhaja Patitanam Pavani.
Vaishnava Jalamo Namaha.
Hi.